You know, they say thanks to cable news that the news cycle is now 24 hours long, which is ridiculously short. You're welcome.
This year has been a pretty good year for me personally. And I hope there's a lot of folks out there that are able to say that as well. Obviously, when old Trumpy got elected last year, I just had all kinds of terrible, terrible, no freaking way do I want to be a part of this upcoming year. Can I just check out? Could I potentially be a citizen of another country for just a little while America, you know, gets out its oogies doing something incredibly stupid like making Donald Trump president? But personally, this past year, that ding-dong aside, has been pretty good for me personally. But there has been something nagging at me. And I think it nags at you too. And for those of us that consume a lot of news, like I do, and like I always have, even as a musician and a DJ, I don't spend my days, you know, my work days, I work in a truck, I don't spend my days listening to music. I usually wait till I get home to listen to music, and then, even then, I'm usually reading or consuming news in some other way. It's constantly surrounded by news. So when I get a lot of news, it's not that much of a shock to my system. I mean, this is what I do. The same as I eat food, I consume a lot of news, I drink plenty of water, I get plenty of rest. I mean, it's normal to me. It's not an abnormal thing, but I feel like for everyone else, it's become an abnormal thing that they consume more news than they ever have. I think more people became woke. More people became conscious after last year's election. Because when David Duke became president, I think a lot of people went, whoa, what's been going on while I wasn't paying attention? Man, in the upcoming year, I think a few people said, I'm going to start paying more attention. And I think other people just said, you know what? I'm going to check out. And then every single day, it's breaking news. And it's huge breaking news. And it's all of these stories that just assault every one of our senses. And we can't handle it. Well, Melvin can handle it. I do this stuff all the time. But I think for the average consumer, they can't. And they go, okay. I'm going to start paying attention. And then Donald Trump stands in front of the native code talkers and uses a racial slur. And then he praises neo-Nazis. And they go, you know what? Maybe this is why I wasn't paying attention the whole time. And it can be assaulting. I mean, it can feel terrible to have all of this coming at you all at once, especially if you've only become woke in the last year. But let me say this. You need to stay engaged. What is happening right now is a form of conditioning. All of this incredibly crazy stuff happens. I remember when George W. Bush was president, thinking that he's the worst president ever. Ever! And then anybody would be worse than him. And then, I suppose that's the challenge. Can't nobody be worse than him? And the GOP says, here, you know, hold my beer. And they managed to pick somebody way worse. And then the American people managed to pick somebody way worse. So the conditioning that's happening right now that I want everyone to be conscious of, all of this amazing stuff is just coming out all the time. And I think the effect is twofold. A lot of people just go to hell with it. This is why I didn't pay attention to begin with. And they just check out. And then for everyone else, they start to see this as normal. The president's a white supremacist. That's normal. He uses racial slurs. That's normal. He aligns himself with far-right nationalist groups. That's normal. You know, he's lying. That's normal. He colludes with Russia. All this stuff becomes normal. Well, let me say this. It is not normal. None of this is normal. This year is markedly different than other years. Last year, very different than other years. And I can say that most of the Obama years were pretty normal. We knew what to expect. We had a president that had some dignity. We had a Congress that absolutely hated his guts. They were racist to his face. They were racist behind his back. And they never, ever saw him as president. He still managed to get a lot of things done with that. The Obama years were all kind of the same year to me. The Bush years were all kind of the same year to me. But from the moment Trump entered our lives, every single year is very different from the last. And the assault just gets on our senses, just gets to be more and more and more. Today, I'm going to talk tax policy. And I'm also going to talk about this assault on our senses, what we can do, what's happened in the last week, and what we can do going forward. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. My name is Melvin, episode number 231, coming up on the holidays. I hope you're getting all your shopping done, you're setting up your trips with your families, and all the rest. I hope it's going to be a very, very merry one for you. I appreciate you listening, and thank you so much for being here. So let me start here. There's an article over at The Guardian from just about 2-3 weeks ago, and the headline goes like this. 30 countries use armies of opinion shapers to manipulate their democracy. Quoting here, the governments of 30 countries around the globe are using armies of so-called opinion shapers to meddle in elections, advance anti-democratic agendas, and repress the citizens. This according to a new report. Manipulation and disinformation tactics played an important role in elections in at least 17 countries over the past year, damaging citizens' ability to choose their leaders based on factual news and authentic debate. Although some governments sought to support their interest and expand their influence abroad, as with Russia's disinformation campaigns in the United States and Europe, in most cases they used these methods inside their own borders to maintain power. Of the 65 countries surveyed, 30, including Venezuela and the Philippines and Turkey, were found to be using these armies of opinion shapers to spread government views, drive particular agendas, and counter government critics on social media. This according to Freedom House's New Freedom on the Net report. In each of these 30 countries, it found strong indications that individuals are paid to distort the digital information landscape in the government's favor without acknowledging sponsorship. So here's the way it goes. Somebody as crooked as Putin gets into power, or Duterte in the Philippines, and it's like an office environment. They set up an office with a bunch of computers, and you're generally paid pretty handsomely because they would like to keep this sort of thing a secret. Of course, it's hard to keep it a secret because the more people that you bring into a conspiracy, the harder it is to keep it a secret. They are given directives, and then all day long, they get on social media, they do email campaigning, and they do commenting on social media, and they just spread all these stories. Of course, they've got fake news sites that come up with fake news, that just come up with pro-government things. So I've always described one of the biggest differences between me and conservatives is, of course, our opinion towards government. I see government as a potential force for good. I believe in the idea of collectivism, and I believe that when people get together with good intentions and good information, they will likely come to a good conclusion, a good consensus. And I believe that we need everybody's consensus on really everything that affects us all. For conservatives, that's that government, no matter what it is. If it's private industry, it's fine. If it's one CEO screwing over millions of people, that's fine. But if one government member screws over even one person, then obviously the entire government is corrupt and it needs to be dissolved. So the differing opinions on government that we have, it's interesting to me that they hate government so much, but it's okay for these private industries to screw people over. So these are propaganda networks, state-sponsored propaganda networks that they have in these other countries. And we can look at that and we can go, oh, God, that's so terrible. In those awful, horrible, repressive countries, they've just got rooms full of people where they come up with government propaganda all day long. Oh, my God, I'm so glad I live in the United States of America, where that kind of thing just is not happening. Except that it is, and it has. And it's been happening for a good long while now. When I started listening to conservative talk radio in 2002 or 2003. And back then, there were no progressive shows. None. I think the longest running progressive show right now is the Tom Hartman Show. And I think it came around in 2003 or 2004. I started listening to conservative talk. And I say conservative because that's all there was. Late 2002, 2003. And I'd listen to it all day, morning, you know, morning and afternoon, morning and afternoon, morning and afternoon, all day long. And I was relatively ignorant on politics. But I would listen to this stuff because I liked the discussions. I didn't understand all the ideas, but I liked the discussions. And I noticed I kept hearing liberal, liberal, liberal. It's a terrible, terrible thing. Liberal, liberal, liberal. The liberals are doing this. The liberals are doing that. The liberals are... And I didn't really look up the word liberal. I felt like I knew what the word liberal meant, not in political terms, but just in general terms. I felt like I knew what the word liberal meant, but I didn't bother looking up. I go, oh, man, these liberals, they sound like terrible people. So I began seeking out progressive sources of information. And when I heard progressives, liberals, Democrats, describe their agenda, I go, now, wait a minute. Their agenda sounds a lot more like my agenda. Their agenda doesn't sound terrible at all. So then I began honestly, people say they do this, but they don't really, began honestly listening to both sides. Around that time, Air America came into the picture. And I would spend, you know, I had a schedule. I would spend my mornings listening to Morning Sedition. And then I would listen to Tom Hartman, and then I would listen to Sean Hannity. But while I was listening to Tom Hartman, I'd switch over to Rush Limbaugh. And I'd listen all day long to both sides. And, you know, Sean was noon to three, you know, and then Limbaugh was nine to noon, and Hartman was nine to noon. And I even listened to Al Franken's show, and I'd listen to all these conservatives and liberals. And then I'm definitely a freaking liberal. But as progressive talk started making more of a wave, started spreading, gaining in popularity, shows like Ed Schultz and Tom Hartman were certainly doing a lot better than any of the stuff on Air America. And Tom started on Air America, but he moved independent pretty quick. And I think he saw the writing on the wall that Air America was eventually going to go away. And as progressives and conservatives have had talk radio forever. Limbaugh started in like 87 or something like that. And it was all day just bashing on people, you know, that didn't like Reagan. And then when Clinton became president, it was just the all day Clinton bashing show. And it became very, very effective. And so it grew. And a few more conservatives get on the radio and it just grows. And it's this thing that grew without any liberals jumping in at all. Just the idea of listening to people talk on the radio all day. At that time, I wasn't with it. Oh, I didn't understand it at all. You're listening to people talk on the radio. I'm listening to the new Dr. Dre record. I wasn't with it at all. But conservatives realize, and they'd see up front, this is entertainment. This is not news. This is entertainment. But then they'd get on there and they talk about news all day. And you can't help but think that what it actually is news, because they sound like they're trying to deliver the news. And those talking points that were on conservative talk radio began making it into the mainstream. And this was before, obviously, this was before the internet really, really caught on. Liberals realized how much power was in talk radio, and then they joined in. But they joined in a little late. And these talking points, because these conservative talkers, and by the way, Limbaugh's a flat-out liar. Not a word of truth leaves that man's mouth. Then came 9/11. Sean Hannity's show started on September 11th, 2001. And Sean Hannity hit the radio waves with that pro-American fever. And anybody dare question the president or his motives or anything, was clearly with the terrorists. And that began the deep, deep polarization in America that was reinforced by talk radio, supposedly not a news source, but now considered by its listeners a news source. Conservative talk radio has only grown over the years because it's a very, very effective tool. I remember hearing, I would hear the president say something in the morning. And it would be on every single conservative talk radio show the rest of the day. Even if the president, and this is George W. Bush, even if he didn't say something in the morning, I would still hear this chorus on conservative talk radio where they all happen to be saying the exact same thing, almost as if they were sharing the exact same brain. And there have been new networks that have started up over the years, conservative talk networks, backed by billionaires, millionaires and billionaires, who were absolutely willing to pay whatever it takes for these opinion shapers, these conservative talk radio opinion shapers, to put all of their right-wing billionaire talking points out there. So, Clear Channel. Clear Channel took on a bunch of the Air America affiliates, and they were doing well. Of course, Air America collapsed, but there's still all these progressive stations out there and these progressive shows that were also doing pretty well. But Clear Channel realized, and I think they wanted to capitalize, but I think they realized their mistake right away because the agenda of the billionaires is the agenda of Clear Channel, which now calls themselves iHeartMedia or iHeartRadio. They realized that their agenda is not the progressive agenda. It's the conservative agenda. And if they keep allowing these progressive stations to exist, well, eventually people are going to come after them too. Because what iHeartMedia wants to do, what Clear Channel wants to do, what the billionaires want, it's not what the people want. So they began dumping their progressive talk stations one by one by one by one. When the one in Portland went, I was stunned. Never thought it would go. Because of how progressive Portland is. They turned it into a talk station, a sports talk station, and it's never, ever recovered. So conservative talk radio is still very much a medium and an influential one. But a lot of those guys have also moved online. There are, and there's documentation for this, there are paid trolls, people who are paid to go on to the progressive talk shows that still exist. And they're paid to cast doubt, paid to argue with the conservative or with the progressive hosts. They're also paid to go online, and they're paid per comment that they put onto progressive pages. And right now, this is happening. And the president, President Donald Trump, whenever I hear him talk, I hear the exact same things leaving his mouth that I have heard leave the mouths of conservative talk show hosts, and I've been listening for that long, for 15 years. The exact BS things, the fake world that they live in, the completely made-up world that they live in, where we supposedly can't say Merry Christmas, where Hillary needs to be locked up, all of the crap, all of the made-up things. I've done my own research to see if any of it's true. All of those things I hear leaving the president's mouth. So we still have a gigantic network that is paid for by conservatives. Yeah, there's some of it supported by advertisers, which is supported by people like you and I. But there's a lot of networks out there that are supported just by these. Case in point. Bill O'Reilly's show. Bill O'Reilly used to, so he's got the O'Reilly Factor, and he used to have a show called The Radio Factor, and nobody listened to it. He's got a show in the night. He's got a show during the day. 4 hours of Bill O'Reilly is too damn much. But he had a 3 hour radio show in the morning, and then he had his 1 hour radio show at night. He just lived politics all day. And eventually people would, even if they liked him, they'd tune into his TV show, but not necessarily to his radio show. So he started losing advertisers. And he started losing financial support. But he was still on the air. Stations were losing money based on what he was bringing in. But they still kept him on the air. What we later found out is that somebody was paying stations, I believe collectively, something like $500,000 a week, somewhere in that neighborhood. It's been a while since I read the story, just to keep Bill O'Reilly on the air. And then that billionaire went ahead and dropped out and goes, you know what? What he's doing on TV, that's enough. We don't need him on the radio too. And then eventually he was taken off the... That's one story. That kind of thing is happening all the time. Keeping these guys on the air because... And think about this. Sean Hannity, probably the second most popular talk show host on the radio. And, of course, Rush Limbaugh. The most popular conservative talk show host on the radio. And then you get into Michael Berry and some of these other ones. These guys, at least those guys in the top two, I can't speak to Berry and some of the others, but those guys in the top two, the two most popular ones, those guys are both millionaires. Millionaires. Almost billionaires. The contract that Limbaugh signed just under 10 years ago, or just about 10 years ago, was worth $400 million. He's a millionaire. His agenda is that of the millionaires. He doesn't get on the air and talk about how rich he is, but he's definitely a millionaire. And Sean Hannity's making tens of millions of dollars a year too. And to think that he's getting on the air and telling you the truth, because God darn it, he's just got to tell you the truth. He's a millionaire. And his agenda is the same as that that props up conservative media, that pays for conservative trolls, props up Fox News, which is nothing but a channel that pushes this neoliberal idea. Now, this idea that we should just get rid of all these programs that help working people and only help billionaires. And so we can say, God, it's a terrible thing. They got all these opinion shapers in other countries. And they're very, very secret. But we've got the same opinion shapers here in America. And it's not so secret. Their agenda, Fox's agenda, is not your agenda. The Blaze, you know, that's the network that Tommy Loren was on. That's Glenn Beck's network. Their agenda is not your agenda. The NRA network, their agenda is clearly not your agenda. But there they are. And there's a ton of money behind them. And it doesn't matter if you listen. It doesn't matter if they have advertisers. Because there's always going to be somebody with deep enough pockets to keep them on the air. Because those are America's opinion shapers. And then that is how we end up right here, right now.
By hiring half of Goldman Sachs to run the economy, Donald Trump has made clear he has no intention of keeping his promise.
Let's not forget, we also have a billionaire president who decided to run for president on the idea that he was going to drain the swamp. And... The minute he found out he was elected, he was on the phone with as many swamp creatures as possible. The state of the world right now goes like this. This, according to The Guardian by Rupert Neat, the headline, richest 1% own half the world's wealth. The world's richest people have seen their share of the globe's total wealth increase from 42.5% at the height of the 2008 financial crisis to 50.1% in 2017. The share of the top 1% has been on an upward path ever since the crisis. That crisis, which screwed all of us, only made them richer. They got richer through the George W. Bush presidency, and they got richer when it crashed. The Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, he of Goldman Sachs, who helped crash the economy, he made billions by foreclosing on people through that crash. The increase in wealth among, quoting here, the already very rich led to the creation of 2.3 million new millionaires over the past year, bringing the total to 36 million. The number of millionaires, which fell in 2008, recovered fast after the financial crisis and is now three times the 2000 figure. These millionaires account for 0.7% of the world's adult population, but they control 46% of the total global wealth. And what's the discussion that we're having right now? What's the discussion that we've been having over these last number of months ever since the Obamacare repeal vote failed? The fact that rich people do not have enough money and that we need to find a way to get them more money.
When we talk about Wall Street and the greed and the recklessness and illegal behavior on Wall Street, I must say that I was really stunned when the Attorney General of the United States recently suggested that it might be difficult to prosecute Wall Street CEOs who commit crimes because of the destabilizing effect that prosecution might have on the financial system of our country and the world. In other words, we have a situation now where Wall Street is not only too big to fail, they are too big to jail. And the theory is that if you're just a regular person, you commit a crime, you go to jail. You're head of a Wall Street company. Your power is so great, the tentacles of that company are so great, that if you are prosecuted and there's destabilization in that company, it can have worldwide or national implications. Mr. President, that is an issue we have got to think long and hard about. We are supposed to be a country of law, and that law should apply to the CEOs of Wall Street companies as well as everybody else.
That idea that we can't do anything about these criminal enterprises that crash the economy, because if we did something about them, it would collapse the world economy. They're too big to jail, too big to fail, right? We can't do anything about them. They should just get to do whatever the hell they want. What should have happened at that point? We used to have this thing in America called the corporate death penalty. Jimmy Carter was the most recent president to use the corporate death penalty. And you break up these, if a company is too big, you break it up into lots of smaller companies. You can't be a massive company in America. These mergers and acquisitions, they're not done in our best interest. They just create these gigantic companies. And yes, there is a degree of truth that if these gigantic companies fail, that there will be some pretty serious repercussions, which is why we should have the corporate death penalty again. Force these companies to break up into smaller companies again. More companies means more employees. That creates more jobs, and there's less of a risk if one company fails. I own a small business right now. I have two employees. And if my business fails, the world's not going to collapse. And there's the idea. But let's say my business grows to 1 million employees or 2 million employees. Let's say it's 500,000 employees. And I decide to do some shady stuff and my company falls and it takes all those jobs with it. Huh? Yeah. Yeah. It's a much worse effect at that time. So the idea should have been after 2008 was all those companies that are too big to fail, break them up so that if they do fail, because they are criminal enterprises, it doesn't take the entire U.S. financial system down with it. What was our response? We gave them a bunch of money. We let them get bigger. Then we hired a billionaire to be president. And now we've got this tax bill in Congress. And it passed the House and the Senate. But it's two different versions. There's one version in the House. There's one version in the Senate. All spending has to start in the House, which it did. It's a people's house. It's in the Constitution. Spending bills have to start in the House. It started in the House, and then it moved on to the Senate. But now that it's passed the Senate and the House versions have to be squared. So there is now a committee that's put together to square those two bills. And if either bill becomes law, or a merging of the bills becomes law. The headline here, I'm a Depression historian, and the GOP tax bill is straight out of 1929. This is by Robert S. McElvain. He's a historian at Millsaps College and the author of The Great Depression, America, 1929 to 1941. Quoting here, there are two sides of government, Williams Jennings Bryan declared in 1896, Cross of Gold speech. There are those who believe that if you only legislate to make the well-to-do prosperous, their prosperity will leak through to those below. The democratic idea, however, is that if you legislate to make the masses prosperous, their prosperity will find its way up through every class which rests upon them. The first idea has never been proven. The latter has. That was more than three decades before the collapse in 1929. The crash followed a decade of Republican control of the federal government. Trickle-down has never, ever worked, but that doesn't seem to faze the Republicans. Quoting here again, in 1926, Calvin Coolidge's Treasury Secretary, Andrew Mellon, one of the world's richest men, pushed through a massive tax cut that would substantially contribute to the causes of the Great Depression. Republican Senator George Norris of Nebraska said that Mellon himself would reap from the tax bill a larger personal reduction in taxes than the aggregate of practically all the taxpayers in the state of Nebraska. That is true now of Donald Trump, the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, and other fabulously rich people. And the article goes on, and he says, I have seen this movie before. The Depression is what he studies. He's written books about it. And he says, we're doing exactly what led to the Republican Great Depression.
We are following breaking news. Just over half an hour ago, the House of Representatives narrowly approved a $4 trillion budget.
A huge win. The vote was 216 to 212, with 20 Republicans voting no. There were no Democratic yes votes, not a surprise. The vote clears a key hurdle toward the president's goal of cutting taxes.
I love economics. I've got an interest in it. I've got an honest interest in it. I probably should have went to college for it, but I read about economics all the time, and I just loves it. And when I read about economics, the countries, the societies that do better, they have a tax policy like this. When the economy is not doing well, you cut taxes. It's better to cut them on regular working people than it is on millionaires and billionaires. There's very little effect for cutting taxes on the rich, because we've cut them tons and tons of time for them. It doesn't seem to do anything. You cut it on working people in bad times, giving them more money, because working people tend to spend most, if not everything, that they make. And then during good times, you raise taxes. And those taxes tend to level the economy out a little bit. You don't have people getting gigantically rich, but you don't have people hurting either. And you use the extra money at that time, the extra treasure at that time, to fix our roads and bridges and all the rest. You know, do more hiring for police and fire. And so during bad times, you cut taxes. During good times, you raise taxes. We are at full employment right now, and the economy is still doing good. And Forbes, which is the rich, the magazine for the rich talking to the rich. Forbes has come out and said, why is the GOP doing the exact opposite right now when we are at full employment? So raw story, reading from a raw story article here, Forbes contributor Stan Collender, an expert who has spent his career working on the federal budget, warned that the Republican tax bill will be a disaster for the American economy. In a piece published recently, he argues that the GOP tax cut, now working its way through Congress, will be part of a decades-long economic policy disaster unlike any that has ever occurred in American history. According to Collender, there's no economic justification for this tax cut at this time. Quoting here, U.S. GDP is growing. Unemployment is close to 4%. Below that is considered full employment. Corporate profits are at record levels and stock markets are soaring. It makes no sense to add any federal government-induced stimulus to this private sector-caused economic activity, let alone a tax cut that is as big as this one. So Forbes has said, are you effing insane? Forbes, not a liberal rag by any stretch of the imagination.
Trump is going to kick off a renewal of the disastrous race to the bottom. And so this is where mostly it's a contest between the U.S. with Wall Street and the United Kingdom with the City of London on who can have the weakest regulation, the weakest supervision, and the least danger of anyone being prosecuted. What we call the three Ds, deregulation, desupervision, and de facto decriminalization.
One of the reports that the conservatives are citing for this tax cut is an open letter to Congress from over 100 economists. This is what it's called, an open letter to Congress from over 100 economists. pass tax reform, and watch the economy roar. So Forbes decided to check out the economists that are on this list. And it turns out some of them aren't even economists. A lot of them don't have any sort of bios or public records. And the ones that are economists tend to be economists that work for right-wing think tanks. So it's not really economists. So who are these people? So the University of Chicago decided to bring in 37 economists, real economists, and they showed them sort of a boiled down version of the House version of the bill. These bullet points, this. So take a look at this. Is this going to hurt the economy or is this going to hurt the economy? And of the 37 economists, 36 of them said that it is going to hurt the economy and that it is only going to hurt rich people. Now, this is true. Okay, 36 of the 37 said that. They released the group. And then the one economist that said no came back into the room and goes, wait a minute. I misunderstood the material. And he goes, I'm sorry. I agree with the other 36 economists. This is going to hurt the economy and it's only going to help rich people. So 37 of the 37 economists, so he leaves, he comes back. 37 of the 37 economists say, this is going to hurt the country. Bloody hell, don't pass this thing. What we're going to see, the minute this thing passes, and it hasn't passed yet, the minute this thing actually passes, because we've got two scores. We've got the CBO score, and we've got the dynamic score. Now, the CBO score, saying it's going to add $1.5 trillion to the deficit, that's the real score. And then we've got the dynamic score, which is the GOP score. Now, real quick, dynamic scoring is completely made up. It's based on the premise that tax cuts grow economies, which they do not, and that the rich doing better helps everyone else. It does not. So dynamic scoring is not a real score. But the GOP loves it because it tells them what they want to hear. And according to the GOP's dynamic scoring, this bill is going to add $1 trillion to the national debt. $1 trillion, not $1.5 trillion. So even under their own made-up scoring model, it's still going to add $1 trillion to the debt. And the minute that this thing hits the president's desk and it gets signed, before it even begins being implemented, you're going to hear the Republicans scream about the deficit without any concern whatsoever about the fact that we've been talking about this for a couple of months now, about how it's going to explode the deficit. And every one of them said it doesn't care. Deficits don't matter. But the minute this thing passes, they're going to be screaming about the deficit. And they're going to say, oh my God, we have to start cutting spending.
Right now, having emergency meetings to get a short-term fix of health care, where premiums don't have to double and triple every year like they've been doing under Obamacare. Because Obamacare is finished. It's dead. It's gone. It's no longer, you shouldn't even mention, it's gone. There is no such thing as Obamacare anymore. It is and I said this years ago, it's a concept that couldn't have worked. In its best days, it couldn't have worked. But we're working on some kind of a short-term fix prior to the Republicans getting together, maybe with some Democrats. Again, it's obstruction, but maybe with some Democrats to fix health care permanently.
The Senate version of the bill does kill Obamacare because it gets rid of the individual mandate, which you need in order to prop the bill up. The healthy people pay for the sick. That's just always the way that it's been. But there's another thing that this is going to do. This is going to pave the way for the Republicans to open up Social Security, which is not an entitlement. It's an earned benefit. An earned benefit that you and I pay our lifetimes into so that we can collect the benefit at the end of our lives. Would you call a 401k an entitlement? Would you call an IRA an entitlement? No. You pay into them and then you get the money back. So with the passage of this bill, as soon as it gets signed, they're going to scream about the deficit. They're going to say we got to make cuts, but They're going to be what they refer to as non-military cuts. We cannot have military cuts. The military, absolutely don't touch the military. That's their baby. You will not cut their baby. And they're going to say, we got to start cutting Medicare. Got to start cutting Medicaid. Got to start cutting Social Security. Even the Social Security is not a part of the deficit at all. It does not add. It's a completely separate thing, funded separately, money kept separate. And it's in the black for at least the next 27 years, no problems. But they're going to go, we got to cut Social Security. They're all of a sudden going to care about the deficit. And then at that point, that's when the killing will commence.
You're saying that the people here who are speaking out came here to ask questions about health care because they will be mostly affected or being cruel or rude for speaking out. But I'll tell you what's rude. Kicking 22 million people off their health care in this country who you know you cannot afford it. You worked at the Earl K. Long Hospital for a long time. You know what people are like at their lowest. So to step on their necks by kicking them off their health care at this point, that's cruel, sir. I think what you need to do as a Louisianian is go back to Washington, D.C. and stand up for the people who are here and saying, we need our health care.
So they've been saying we need to pass this bill because this money will trickle down to you. There will be more jobs. If you have a job, you will be paid more. All of this is going to go to you. So Bloomberg decided to find these captains of industry, these masters of the universe, and say, hey, the money that you're going to get from the tax cut, what are you going to do with it? So, quoting here from Bloomberg, major companies including Cisco Systems, Pfizer Inc., and Coca-Cola say they will turn over most gains from the tax cut to their shareholders. This, of course, undercuts what President Donald Trump said about how it's going to create jobs and boost the middle class. Instead of hiring more workers or raising pay, many companies say they'll first increase dividends or buy back their own stock. And when they buy back their own stock, it reduces the amount of stock that's out there, reduces the inventory, which only raises the price of the stock, which makes them more money and more money for their shareholders. Robert Bradway, chief executive of Amgen, said in an October 25th earnings call that the company has been actively returning capital in the form of growing dividend and buyback, and I'd expect us to continue that, he said. Executives including Coca-Cola CEO James Quincey, Pfizer Chief Financial Officer Frank D'Amelio, and Cisco CFO Kelly Kramer have recently made similar statements. Companies are sitting on large amounts of cash. They're not really financially constrained. And there was a survey conducted by John Shin, a foreign exchange strategist at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. And he said these 300 companies, with their extra money, they're just going to pay themselves more money. None of this. And this is by their own admission, these companies' own admission. None of it. This isn't politics. All these companies said, nope, no, absolutely not. We will be buying back our own stock. We'll be paying bigger dividends. We'll be paying ourselves more money. We'll be buying ourselves more private jets. We're not going to do anything for you.
I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget a little out of whack because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine. We've saved a lot of lives. If you look at the every death is a horror. But if you look at a real catastrophe like Katrina, and you look at the tremendous hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that died, and you look at what happened here with really a storm that was just totally overpowering. Nobody's ever seen anything like this. And what is your death count as of this moment? 17?
16 certified.
16 people certified. 16 people versus in the thousands.
Real quick, about that clip. The numbers, which aren't official government numbers, but they're journalists that are over there, that are watching, that are looking through the morgues and all the rest, tracking deaths from previous years. Those numbers are supposedly right now, official government numbers are in the dozens or in the low hundreds. But these journalists who are on the ground in Puerto Rico say that the number is now in the thousands, easily in the thousands of people who have died as a result of government inaction after that storm. And for Donald Trump to go there and say, you are ruining our budget, Puerto Rico. You are ruining our budget. That is just the height of absolute callousness. And then to come back to America and push this bill, which is going to add trillions to the deficit, throw people off of their health care, cut the earned benefits that people have been working for their whole lives. We refer to this as trickle-down economics, or voodoo economics, as George H.W. Bush called it before he became Ronald Reagan's vice president. But this idea that giving more to the rich will trickle down to everyone else has been around for a long time, really almost as long as the Republican Party has been. They used to refer to this in the late 1800s as horses and sparrows. Quoting here from an article over at the Maine Times, supply-side economics aren't really unique to the last quarter of the 20th century and beyond. The model known pejoratively as trickle-down economics had another name in the past. This model, largely created with the 1896 panic, was called horse and sparrow economics. So here's the way it goes. Horse and sparrow economics. So horses eat what's on the ground, and horses, they've got fairly inefficient digestive systems. They digest some things, and sorry if this is going to be gross, but just for a minute. So if you don't want to hear it, you can just skip past for a minute. Horses have fairly inefficient digestive systems. And so the things that come out of the back end of the horse, those things end up being food for other things. Food for the land, food for other animals, and food for the sparrows. Sparrows like to eat the undigested, it's because it's easier for the sparrows to eat right out of the thing that the horse produces, because it's for their digestive system, it's already somewhat digested. So they called it horse and sparrow because give everything to the biggins, and whatever comes out of the back end, you can go ahead and pick through it. That's what you get. Horses and sparrows trickle down. It's the exact same thing. So where is the action going to come from with respect to this tax bill? The bill has not passed yet, but it's being worked out, and it could still pass. So now that it's passed the House and it's passed the Senate, the House could simply adopt the Senate's bill and then send it to the president's desk and it's law. Boom. But something happened. Something happened when they were quickly, and I mean very quickly, passing this law. So there are some videos that went around on the internet. One of the more famous ones was from John Tester from Montana. And he got the bill just a couple hours before they were supposed to vote on it. And there were all kinds of things written into the margin. I mean, this thing was really sloppily passed. There were no hearings on this bill. There was absolutely no debate. And I remember when Obamacare passed it, there was no hearings. There was no dang gum debate. But there was. There were dozens of hearings and hundreds of hours of debate over Obamacare. And some of the things that Republicans wanted actually ended up in the Obamacare bill. No, it didn't. It just shoved it down our throat. That's what we were told. Hey, the Obamacare dang just shoved down our throats. No, it wasn't. But if you're into throat shoving, well, that's what this bill does. Because no debate, no hearings. And the bill gets sent around and things are written into the margins. It was passed so sloppily that the Republicans forgot one gigantic thing. We have something known as the alternative minimum tax, the AMT. And what this, I won't get too wonky on this for you, but what the AMT is if, because there's all these tax loopholes that we have. And if you manage to use all those loopholes as a billionaire, millionaire, use all those loopholes to your advantage to where you get your tax rate down to nothing or near nothing, then the AMT kicks in. And the AMT sees that you pay something. The alternative minimum tax, it sees that you pay something. In the 1 year of tax returns that we have from Donald Trump, that's the tax year 2005, if I'm not mistaken. In that tax return, we saw that the only tax that Donald Trump paid that year was the AMT. And the Republicans, as a part of their tax bill, wanted to get rid of the AMT. And because they passed this thing in the middle of the night, writing things in the margin at the very last minute, and passed it without any hearings and any debate, they forgot to put the repeal of the AMT into this bill. And all of their corporate backers are freaking out right now because that was supposed to be in there. They really, really need that. It's a tax cut for Donald Trump. Also, Donald Trump wants that in there. If it were in the House bill, but not the Senate bill, it would still have to be voted on in the House. You know, the House can't just, they could just adopt the House bill, but they didn't. They went ahead and they wrote their own bill. And so now that the two bills are being squared, the Republicans are not going to let this thing become law without the repeal of AMT. And so it has to be written in. It's one of the key things. It's one of the gigantic things that they really, 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 really want in there. So since this thing is not law yet, and these bills have to be squared, I was going to read all the names here, but it's a fairly long list of names. Look this up. There's a committee right now in Congress that is squaring these two bills. And your House member or your senator, I know my House member is, so my House member is going to hear from me, Jamie Herrera Butler. They are going to, I want to read all the names. It's fairly long, but look it up. The committee that is squaring these two bills right now, they need to hear from you. They need to hear, and if we can put this thing off to the end of the year, it's very unlikely that they're going to be able to pass this thing next year. There's still a way to defeat this bill. And even if your House member or your senator is not a part of that committee, call them anyway. Keep hammering on them. This is not over yet. This thing is not law, and it's not going to become law until they can get the repeal of the AMT put in there. And so they need to hear from you to make sure that this does not pass, that this thing does not become law. Yeah, it passed the House and the Senate, but they're not just going to adopt the House version because it doesn't have the repeal of the AMT. They need the repeal of the, they need that in there, and they forgot to put that in there. And so that thing is really going to hang this up, and they're not going to pass it without it. And you need, they need to hear from you to make sure that it does not get in there and this thing does not pass, because we can still cut off the funding for the United States Republican Party. Now, I want to leave you with one last thing before I go. This is an article. Trump proposes massive one-time tax on the rich. Yes, you heard that correctly. Billionaire businessman Donald Trump, this is not The Onion, has a plan to pay off the national debt, grant a middle-class tax cut, and keep Social Security afloat. Tax rich people like himself. Trump, a prospective candidate for the presidential nomination, is proposing a one-time net worth tax on individuals and trusts worth $10 million or more. By Trump's calculations, his proposed 14.25% levy on such net worth would raise $5.7 trillion and wipe out the national debt in one full swoop. The national debt increased by $9.7 billion in September, but remains at $5.66 trillion, according to the latest Treasury figures. The net worth tax is the cornerstone of Trump's economic plan released recently. No one has put forward a plan to make this country entirely debt-free as we enter the next millennium, Trump said in a written statement. You're kind of getting where this is going now, right? The plan I'm proposing today does not involve smoke and mirrors, phony numbers, financial gimmicks, or the usual economic chicanery that you usually find in Disneyland on the Potomac, Trump said. Trump would exempt the value of an individual's principal home from the net worth total. By my calculations, 1% of Americans who control 90% of the wealth in this country would be affected by my plan. The other 99% of the people would get deep reductions in their federal income taxes. He said, hey, this would hurt me, but he goes, we need to get the economy back to working for working people. and we should do this. This is according to Phil Hirschhorn at CNN, November 9th, 1999, when one Donald J. Trump was running for the presidential nomination on the reform ticket. This was actually proposed by him. And so that Donald Trump, and square it with this Donald Trump now, who's really doing the exact opposite. This man who, when he talks, really just a walking, talking, right-wing talking point. If they're saying it off, he does most of his tweeting when Fox and Friends is on. And he tends to tweet whatever's being said on Fox and Friends. And Fox and Friends knows that. And so they will, when they are planning their shows, they will put things into their show that they want the president to say when he's out and about, that they want him to put into tweets, because they know. So it's unfortunate, but this whole right-wing network, the vast right-wing conspiracy that Hillary warned us about, it's a real live thing, and it's very well-funded. And it has grown so much that now Fox and Friends, yes, Fox and Friends, is now the most powerful television show effectively in the world. If our president is the leader of the free world, this is now the most powerful television show, because he watches it, they know he watches it, and he watches it, and he repeats everything that he hears on there and tweets it out. This that started as just a right-wing network has become an opinion, an army of opinion shapers. And they tell us what to think, and they tell him what to think, and then he delivers it to us. So where are we at in closing? Hopefully, you understand a little bit more about how we got here, how our information pipeline is what it is. And the tax bill. Yes, this is not over yet. We can continue to fight for this. Oh, and for the for last Thursday, all of the protests outside of the Verizon store, I was not able to make it because I was working, but I work in a truck. So I was able to drive by and see outside of all of the Verizon stores, all of the people that were gathered together protesting Verizon. That vote is coming up next week. And depending on how that turns out, I'll talk about it on a later show. But I want to say I saw everybody out there. And you looked absolutely wonderful. And I honked at you, my big old truck. And I was so happy to see that. Democracy in action. We can make this stuff happen. We can fight the repeal of net neutrality. And we can fight this stupid tax bill. This isn't over yet, but it's going to require your action. And it's not enough for me to just bark here on the radio. And it's not enough for you to just listen. Start calling that Congress member and tell them that, well, be nice, be diplomatic, but be firm, because this doesn't have to be the way it is. And 2018, hey, 2018 might even be a better year than 2017 was for you. Hopefully, 2017 was good for you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on the Fiery Camp at our official home, tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store. Just search for the Fire You Can't Put Out there. You can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the Fire You Can't Put Out, and we will prevail. Rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and special thanks to you for listening. This is Melvin signing off. And now that I have woken you up, good morning.